Welcome to the America Magazine podcast. I'm joined today by my colleague, Kevin Clark. Welcome, Kevin.
Thank you, Tim. Thanks for having me.
Well, Kevin is here to report back on a trip he made to Haiti on the third anniversary of the devastating earthquake. Kevin, maybe you can let us know first how this trip came about.
Well, we were looking at the calendar and realizing a couple of months back that the third anniversary of the devastating January 12th earthquake in Haiti was coming up. And we thought we'd try to get an idea of how far the nation, the people have come since the earthquake in terms of recovery. Back in December, I went down to Port-au-Prince and spent a few days there with the very kindly and thoughtful people at Catholic Relief Services. And so they took me on a tour of some of the sites that they're working with, some of the neighborhoods and the people they're working with in Port-au-Prince, just to get an idea of how things are improving in the city and in the country since the earthquake. It was a, Haiti is a country with a lot of long-term economic, climate, topographical, pretty much from any angle you look at, the nation has got some issues to deal with, including problems with its with deforestation, rampant unemployment. Something like half the population is really involved in the gray market. 70% unemployment, I believe, in the formal market. So it's a country facing some difficult challenges already. Without the earthquake, and the earthquake came along and really set the country back even further. Many public institutions were destroyed. Many church institutions were destroyed. Thousands of government employees were killed, as were hundreds of church employees, teachers. Something like 1,000 teachers were killed in Port-au-Prince alone. So it really was, and I believe it was 40,000 students were killed. So it really was a devastating experience. And it's going to take a very long time for them to come back from that. So we thought we'd go back 3 years later and just see what we could find out about conditions now.
Well, if you compare it to, the East Coast storm we just had, and they're talking about, this is Sandy, $60 billion worth of federal aid needed to rehabilitate the devastated areas. But the numbers are much smaller in Haiti, yet the devastation is so great.
Yeah, people sort of are shocked at the figures when we talk about Haiti. There's something like $3 to $4 billion that's already been spent on the recovery, and another $3 to $5 billion, I believe, depending on what sources you're citing, are in the pipeline for restoration. So we're in the ballpark of around $9 or $10 billion. And that's a figure that shocks a lot of people. But as you say, when you compare it to what the United States is considering in terms of restoration following Hurricane Sandy, it's a significant dollar amount. There's no two ways about that. But I believe we spend more annually on pet care in the United States than this entire sum would be to restore Haiti. And really, the devastation was shocking beyond all normal standards. Something like 300,000 people were killed, thousands more injured. Thousands upon thousands of structures collapsed, government structures, church structures, homes, residences, businesses, and all of that's got to get rebuilt. And it's got to get rebuilt in a country that's already suffering from extreme poverty. Something like 80% of the population lives on less than $2 a day. It has profound infrastructural problems. The road systems in and out of the capital are really in very poor repair. It's unclear how much is owing to the earthquake itself and how much is just disrepair because of neglect and poor construction. So it's a country that's going to need assistance, a country that has received assistance for many, many years. And I guess the challenge will be, can we help rebuild Haiti in such a way now that it can stand on its own within a decade or so and start moving forward?
One of the challenges, as you said, is just sort of the crisis situation there where people are hungry, they don't have places to live. So a lot of the money seems to be going just to meet those needs.
Well, yeah, as I said, there, we're talking in the vicinity of $9 or $10 billion, and a lot of people have been asking, including a lot of Haitians, where is that money? Show us what's being done with this money. And I got the impression from the people I worked with and talked with in the NGO community in Port-au-Prince that they're perhaps growing a little exasperated by that question because, millions, billions have been spent. But as they point out, the way the money is spent, it's hard to see anything concrete. You can't point to a structure and say, well, we built this, although that's what is happening now, because most of that money was spent just in survival mode, just keeping people alive. So the survival of the people really is all the evidence you have of how the money was spent in the last few years. And, you know, on top of the earthquake, then there was quickly a cholera epidemic that apparently was brought in by some of the United Nations peacekeepers, unfortunately, contaminated the water supply. And because there is such poor infrastructure in Haiti, it quickly spread because of the poor sanitation. And thousands died, thousands more were made ill by the epidemic, and it's persisting. Unfortunately, they still have little micro outbreaks of cholera, and it's not clear how long it's going to take to eradicate that. People are hungry, you know, they're just plainly hungry. Hurricane Sandy, we know what it did to the east coast of the United States, but it also devastated Haiti. Unfortunately, it devastated the agricultural areas of Haiti, so that the next few months they'll be looking at food shortages. So that's going to be another impending crisis that the NGO community there is already aware of and is already preparing for. But once again, it's going to be the kind of spending of money that's not going to be something they can point to and say, this is how we've helped Haiti come back from the earthquake. Now, having said that, there are large-scale construction projects that are being undertaken now. One of them that I saw was the St. Francis de Sales Hospital that Catholic Relief Services is organizing, partly funding with the help of the United States Catholic Health Association and a group from Dominican Republic called Su Futuro. They are rebuilding what had been a pretty much a completely demolished site. I think 25 of 27 hospital buildings collapsed on January 12th. The death toll was horrible. And in fact, the people I spoke to there, the construction engineers, told me they were still pulling out human remains as they sifted through the site as they were preparing it for reconstruction. So, I mean, it's a tough slog. That site will be, that hospital will be restored, they believe, by June of 2014, and that will be a significant step forward for Haiti, actually for the whole area, the nation and the Caribbean, because CRS hopes that this will be a teaching hospital. It'll be a 200-bed facility, but it'll also be a place where doctors from all over the region can come to learn, to get their accreditation or to improve their skills, and so it should have a real positive impact on the whole area.
Now, the piece you have in America on your trip called Road to Recovery, you mentioned that Haiti is known as the Republic of NGOs. What is the relationship of the NGOs, and what is the role of the government as opposed to the NGOs?
Well, that's a tricky subject, and not something the NGO community wants to talk on record about, unfortunately, I think, because it can lead to more tension. But historically, the government in Haiti has not been the kind that a lot of donors, in the past, the donors might fund projects through the government, but they've been sort of disappointed in the outcome. Either inefficiency or corruption has led to less than positive outcomes. So in recent years, donors have been sort of circumventing the Haitian government, not without cause. The Transparency International reports Haiti as the ninth most corrupt government in the world right now. So until they improve that profile, I don't think a lot of donors are going to be turning over large sums of money to the government. And that creates a certain amount of tension among the Haitians, the average Haitians on the streets and the government, who feel a little slighted by this, the way this is happening. So what you end up with is sort of an army of NGOs, overseas workers coming into Haiti, driving around in their white, jeeps and trucks, and a populace watching these people drive by and, enjoying some air conditioning creature comforts that are unknown to them, and the government sort of being cut out of the restoration work. And that's where sort of the tension is focused. I believe there, so far the Haitian government has only received about 10% of all the donor funding that has been sent down to Haiti after the earthquake. And it creates sort of a catch-22 because the government doesn't get the opportunity and government bureaucrats don't get the opportunity to improve their professionalism, learn the skills they need to learn to run a country because they're so often left out of the process. And so much of what the government should be doing is being assumed by the NGOs. I think something like 70% of what in a functioning government would be is presumed to be a government function is now being done by NGOs in Haiti. So until you can rebalance that formula, I think the government's going to be trapped in this position where it really can improve itself until it gets access to some of the funding and starts exploring its skills and improving its skills.
Now, Catholic Relief Services, I think you mentioned that this is their largest operation is in Haiti. What work are they involved in right now?
Yeah, Haiti represents the largest overseas operation for Catholic Relief Services. And I believe they have over 600 employees, and that's both foreign, international, and national staff, and hundreds of programs, hundreds of local partners. And really, they're involved in virtually every aspect of life in Haiti, from job creation to encouraging entrepreneurship to sanitation work. And that's anywhere from teaching people how to have better sanitation skills to actually digging latrines and establishing rainwater collection sites. Because really, the infrastructure in Haiti is, in some parts of the city, in Port-au-Prince, is non-existent. There's no water pipes, there's no sanitation, there's no drainage, there's no garbage disposal. And so you can imagine there's something like 3 million people in Port-au-Prince without normal garbage disposal. You can imagine what happens. A lot of the garbage is thrown into trenches and gullies when the rains come, these unbelievable piles of garbage choke the canals and drainage ditches of the city, and creating an unbelievable mess and a very unsanitary situation, unhealthy situation for everyone. CRS is also involved in, they built something like 10,000 transitional housing units for people to emerge from the emergency shelters after the earthquake. And they're involved in a lot of agricultural development, and as I said, job creation services. Really, just sort of the whole gamut of any sort of development work that you could imagine.
And you filed a report about one potential project. This is a video we'll link to.
Oh, yeah. That was an afternoon I spent in a neighborhood of Port-au-Prince called Solino, which is what they refer to as being in the red zone. And that's a neighborhood where few NGOs dare to venture. In fact, few government workers dare to venture. But the people of Solino have learned to trust Catholic Relief Services, so they're they might be the only operating relief and development agency in that part of Port-au-Prince. So they're in there helping to rebuild and reconstruct, and one of the major projects they'd love to get started is restoring what had been a recreation field back to its previous use. In the aftermath of the earthquake, virtually any open field in town became an emergency shelter site. So this soccer field was transformed into a site for something like 700 families who lived there in a tent city for almost 3 years. Now, they've been relocated. CRS was able to get them relocated with rent subsidies around the city. So the people are gone, but the wreckage and the destruction of the site remains to be dealt with. So they would love to return that soccer field back to its original use and improve it with a community center, basketball courts, a baseball field. And this would be just about the only recreational facility in the entire neighborhood of Solino. So it really, you know, when you think about living in a slum and surviving under difficult circumstances, it would be a huge benefit to the people of this community to have a place to go, a green field, place to relax, to hold community events, musical festivals, meetings, that sort of thing. That's one of the projects that CRS hopes to undertake this year as they pursue reconstruction in Port-au-Prince.
One of the intriguing elements of your story, you say that even amidst these difficult situations, people still get dressed for church. Kids look, you know, very well
immaculate,
turned out.
Yeah, immaculate.
For school. So there were some signs of hope.
Well, you know, like everything in Haiti, there's a sign of hope and there's sort of an immediate concern. I saw a lot of kids, like kids everywhere, no matter what their circumstances, they find a way to be joyful and have fun. I mean, I saw kids living in these transitional shelters under very difficult circumstances who were still just lovely and having a ball playing with us. But I was really impressed by the school kids turning out every morning, emerging from these tent cities and from these slums, and you would not believe just how wonderfully prepared for school they are. And as a parent of four, I was deeply, deeply embarrassed to think about how immaculate these kids looked compared to my own four kids getting shoved off to school in the morning in good old Northern Westchester with their torn jeans. And, if I get a comb through one of their hair in the morning, I'm very pleased with myself. I was struck as a parent by how terrific these kids looked. And now the downside is that something like 50% of the kids are not going to school. So I saw the 50% of the kids who were lucky enough to get off in the morning to school. And this is grade school. So 50% of the grade school kids in Port-au-Prince are receiving little sort of a negligible education experience. The Catholic schools educate something like 20% of the kids in the city. The government schools educate maybe 15 to 16%. So the government is really not doing its job there in terms of providing an education for all the kids. The rest of the kids are going to private schools that are, some of them are very dubious, sophistication and capacity. So that's something that the whole country needs to look at. But the schools I did visit, it was remarkably encouraging to see these kids, getting to class. And some of them are in very difficult circumstances. A lot of the schools collapsed. You know, thank God the earthquake struck when it did at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, because had it struck a few hours earlier, the death toll among school children would have just been horrific. But most of the schools were empty, so the loss of life was not so great. But the schools themselves are gone, and they're still being restored. So I saw kids taking classes in the parish rectory and just in hallways, really anywhere they could throw the kids together. And this is 3 years now that this has been going on. I saw kids taking classes in buses donated from the Dominican Republic. So, this is all part of the reconstruction that has to take place.
Maybe we can end with a story that you tell about one individual. We've been talking a lot about general statistics, but one boy that you encountered and wrote about on our blog.
Yeah, I guess it's a story about the smallness of the world now and the power of the internet in a very small way. I met one of the camps I visited in Caradu, the Caradu neighborhood of Port-au-Prince. It was a transitional living site that CRS was helping to manage for, I'm gonna have to say maybe 1,000 families. It was a very significant sized site. And pretty much as soon as I arrived, I began being followed by a little boy who turns out, I guess, was about 8, and it turns out he was 8 years old. And I quickly realized that he could not speak and apparently could not hear. And he basically tagged along for the most of the time I was there at the community. I asked some of the kids that I met if they knew who he was, and they all knew of him. You know, they kind of played with him and took care of him, but nobody knew what his name was. And it was partly obviously because he was mute and deaf and couldn't really communicate with them. And I asked some of the educators there what were the prospects for a boy like this in a country as poor as Haiti, and they basically, very sadly told me that he had very poor prospects for the future. You know, that only a few kids like him get into school at all, and they just don't have the capacity to deal with a kid with disabilities like that. So I wrote up the story. I called it The Silent Boy of Caradu. Very quickly, a number of our readers volunteered to help fund this little boy's education, and we were able to backtrack with the help of Catholic Relief Services to find the boy at the camp. And on the positive note here is he is now has already started going to the Institute Montfort, which is a boarding school for kids with who are deaf and with other disabilities. And that, I should point out, the Montfort Institute, which is run by the Daughters of Wisdom, also lost its school. So they're in the process of rebuilding their school, and I think the kids are in temporary classrooms right now. But anyhow, this young man, his name is Davidson, he was 8 years old. You know, he has a chance. I don't know where this story is going to end. We can't predict now what's going to happen to Davidson, but he's got a chance now that he didn't have a couple of weeks ago.
Well, you can read that story on our blog and also see the video report from the neighborhood of Salino. So we want to thank Kevin Clark for all his reporting and for talking with us today.
Thanks, Tim.